Welcome to Visionaries Global Media, your number one source for podcasting entertainment. Visionaries Global Media, envisioning excellence on a global scale.
Welcome to episode 22 of the SJP Wrestling Podcast. I am Si, your host, and I want to say thank you very, very much for pressing play and taking the time to listen to my show. I hope that people enjoyed the bonus show which came to you the weekend just gone with the head guy and in-ring talent Vinicius from the CCW promotion in Florida. I really, really enjoyed the chat. I thought it was really informative, really interesting to hear how promoting shows during the pandemic in the States is different from state to state and so on. I really enjoyed it, and I hope to have him back on the show very soon. If the odd bonus show here and there is something you enjoy or something you like having a bit of a surprise just come out on your podcast providers, please let us know. You can contact the show at SJP Wrestling Pod on Twitter and Facebook. We also have an Instagram account, but it's easier to get hold of me on the Twitter, really. But yep, just search SJP Wrestling Pod. On today's show, it's trying something a bit new with the two different formats of the show that we have. Mainly, the two formats the show follows are, one, I look back on old pay-per-views, older events, old moments, I guess, with various different guests, other content creators, podcasters, and so on, which I really enjoy doing. And then I also like interviewing people from the world of wrestling, whether that's promoters, wrestlers themselves, from different independent shows, and so on, which, again, I really enjoy doing as well. Today, I'm sort of trying something a bit different and combining the two. Way back on episode 2, the first interview I actually did, we had David Eaton from the Heritage City Hitmen join me for a chat about how he got started in wrestling and his career, his likes, his dislikes, and everything in between, really. It was a really great chat, and Dave's really intelligent and well-informed wrestling fan as well as individual. On that discussion, he mentioned the Royal Rumble 2000 when it was airing on Channel 4 in the UK, which is a free-to-view channel for those of you who don't live in the UK who may not be aware. He said that was the pay-per-view that kind of got him into wrestling in the first place. So we sort of thought it'd be great to go back and maybe review a pay-per-view, but with someone who has actually been in the ring and maybe has a different insight or a different point of view to someone like myself who hasn't been in the ring. I hope to be able to, through David's eyes and this discussion, provide you all with maybe a different viewpoint to one of just my own sort of lack of educated self, I guess, with regards to the actual in-ring workings. And I hope David and I's discussion is really interesting for you to hear. Again, I hope that everyone can jump on the social medias, the Instagram, the Facebook, and the Twitter. Find the show at SJP Wrestling Pod. Chuck it a follow. Let us know what you think. See if this is something you enjoy, then this is something we can look at doing more of. I've got other guests who have been on the show and other guests who are coming up who I've also expressed an interest on reviewing more pay-per-views with me. So if this is something you're interested in or something you enjoy hearing, please let me know. As with anything else, really, whether it's something you like, something you dislike, by all means, let me know. And it helps me shape the show to what people want to hear. Okay, that's enough from me, really. Thank you again for pressing the play button. And I hope you enjoy this week's show. Thank you.
All
I am over the moon, absolutely delighted to be welcoming back a guest from one of the very early SJP Wrestling Podcast episodes. Somebody I respect a great deal as a wrestler and somebody I respect a great deal from talking to about wrestling, Mr. David Eaton. It's an absolute joy to have you back on. How are you doing, sir?
Hello, thank you for having me back. Hello. My pleasure, Nathan. I'm doing great, actually. Pretty good, despite the continuing COVID. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. It's, it's a challenge still, isn't it? I mean, it's one thing I was going to ask you about before we started looking into our main topic today. The COVID situation, last time we spoke, everything was very much locked down. There was no end in sight, I guess. Shows for yourself had all been called off and everyone was very much just in limbo. Since I last spoke to you a few months back, I suppose we've come out of a lockdown, gone back into one, and now we're kind of half in, half out, depending on where you live, I guess. It's a little bit confusing. How have things been with yourself? I mean, is there light at the end of the tunnel for you with regards to wrestling?
I don't know. I think so. So since we last spoke, I think I've actually had a wrestling show, which was really interesting, actually, because there's a new startup called EVM Wrestling in Evesham in Worcestershire. Yes. And they just managed to sneak in a socially distant show. They had about 30 fans there in this sort of reasonably small venue. But it was such an experience to have like a socially distanced wrestling show, and I'm kind of glad that they managed to squeeze that in literally the week before we went back into lockdown again. It was a unique thing that probably we'll get to do again, I would imagine, once we come out of lockdown and into whatever set of restrictions we end up in sort of after Christmas in the new year or whatever. But I think there is light at the end of the tunnel, isn't there? There's the vaccine rolling out and plans seem to be in place for sort of beginning to open things up again. So it's just a case of hope for the best, I think, more than anything at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I had the gentleman who runs the EVM company on a little while ago, interviewed him for the show. And that was our main topic of conversation, really, the show that you actually wrestled on there in December, I believe it was, wasn't it? And and how he had to figure things out with regards to people who were supposed to be on the show coming back with positive tests, so we had to replace them last minute and making sure the venue was socially distanced properly. So an absolutely fascinating discussion. And when that interview is released, I'll tag you in it so you can have a listen. It's a really interesting conversation with how I suppose the ups and downs and the grief he had trying to get that show on, I guess, as how he was explaining it to me.
Absolutely. I think it's like, it was quite a surreal experience being there. And I have the greatest respect for promoters anyway, because I think in a lot of ways, it's one of the sort of hardest things in the world to put together a wrestling show. Yeah. And not something that I'd like to sort of delve into at any point in my future, at the very least. I'm perfectly happy being on the performer side. But the, like, everything that goes into a wrestling show is enough, right? Is enough of a headache. To get the venue and the talent and everything organized and in place and safe and ready for a show on a given date with tickets sold and everything. But to do that and also to have concerns about keeping talent safe, making sure they're well and protected and that fans are safe and well and protected and that nobody's like they're at risk of each other on top of that, like, He did an astounding job of all of that. And when he did have issues with talent testing positive, super near the show date as well, I hats off to him for handling that in the way that he did. It was great.
Yeah, it's unprecedented times, isn't it? This whole scenario is new to everybody. And seeing how people are sort of adapting and still managing to get shows out there to entertain people, it is brilliant. I spoke with a gentleman who runs a company in America, the CCW company in Florida, I believe. They have issues with regards from going from state to state or area to area, because different areas in America are very much governed by different laws. So whereas they're working, putting a show on in one particular area and everything socially distanced with a mask and that's the law, they travel down the road to another city somewhere, or wherever it may be, another region or state, or however they word it. And he explained that it was horrific because these people are saying, well, we don't have to wear a mask. Our governor says we don't have to. And it was a completely different scenario to the show he'd ran the week previous. Adapting in those scenarios, again, like you said, I've got the utmost respect for all the promoters that put on shows anyway, but doing it in this era, this time frame for everyone, these added challenges are just insane.
Yeah,
definitely. Okay, well, I mean, one of the reasons we have you back on today is to look back at an old pay-per-view. The reason this one particular pay-per-view, the Royal Rumble 2000, was selected is because when we first spoke on the show back, straight back on episode 2, I believe it is, you mentioned that Royal Rumble 2000 was one of the first shows you remember watching. That's correct?
The first show, yeah. I'm pretty sure this was the first wrestling show that I saw. It was on a VHS tape that I borrowed from a friend who had, like, recorded it off of, I don't know if it was Sky or Channel 4 or whatever it was on at the time.
Channel 4.
And let me borrow it. And yeah, that was the start of me enjoying wrestling.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's great. I mean, it's funny. I've had a few people since I spoke with you say the same thing, that this event was one of the starting points for their fandom. I guess because it was accessible. For a bit of context for anyone listening who's not in the UK, our friends in America who listen, for example, in the UK, you have paid TV services such as Sky and BT and cable, Virgin Media, and so on. And they're the sort of your cable TV providers, and you pay for the packages. They're not accessible in every home. Some of them are very expensive. And you have sports packages with these, and that's where the WWE is. Well, always has been sort of predominantly shown ever since the first time it was broadcast in this country. In this time period, in 2000, the Royal Rumble 2000 was actually the very first one. Channel 4 in the UK, which is a free-to-air station, every home has access to it, every home in the UK has access to Channel 4, struck a deal with the WWE, or WWF as it was then, to carry 4 or 5 pay-per-views throughout that year, and also show Sunday Night Heat. And it was a big, big deal for the WWF having a platform such as Channel 4. I suppose same as AEW now having a platform with ITV, same sort of principle. It's a free station available in every home. So it was a huge platform for that company. Sadly, it soured quickly, that arrangement between Channel 4 and WWE, but we'll get to that a bit later on, I guess. Yeah, so we just decided, because it was that first show that meant a lot to you, that we go back and have a little look at it. Roughly 20 years ago, well, this month, January, so.
Yeah, that's fascinating, actually. I didn't know that was the first event that was on free-to-air. I mean, I guess that makes sense, and it makes sense why everybody sort of discovered it as their first show in that case. But I had no idea. That's actually fascinating.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was going to sort of touch upon it a little bit more when we get into the Miss Rumble contest with Mae Young and so on.
Yeah,
right. Because that's kind of relevant to the topic. But we'll, as soon as you brought it up, we'll discuss it now. The first pay-per-view broadcast was the 2000 Royal Rumble that we're talking about today, broadcast on Channel 4. Again, like I said, free-to-air channel. Anyone can pick up Channel 4, turn it on, and watch it. There's obviously the moment that everyone who has gone back and watched the show or saw it first time round can remember. They have a Miss Rumble 2000 competition where you have numerous ladies come out dressed in typical Attitude Era diva garb, I guess.
Some of those swimsuits, man. If we're talking about this now, I think the less said about this particular segment, the better, particularly in 2020.
Yes.
And some of those swimsuits caught me by surprise. I did not remember those. And I was watching as a 13-year-old kid at the time. So I guess that's kind of surprising. But
yeah. You had... It's effectively a swimsuit competition, I guess, but they're effectively dressed more like strippers, to be fair. You know, and
they're pretty much naked. Watching Ivory kind of made me uncomfortable because she was doing the gimmick and not wanting to be there, but like either selling it really well or really didn't want to be there.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It is uncomfortable because it's almost like she's being pushed into doing this against her will, and that's not nice to look back on now, I guess, you know?
I think probably when I first watched this, we skipped this bit because like my parents were probably in the room or something as well. Like that's something we talked about last time where it was like... one of the worst things about this era of wrestling was watching it with your parents because there was a lot of adult content going on in between the wrestling, which was equally adult at times, but like sort of very oriented at adult males type content. I guess at the time either like my parents fast forwarded that bit or we just kind of looked away from each other and away from the screen and got a bit embarrassed at the time.
Yeah, I can imagine. But I mean, you're spot on. Some of the swimsuits, and I use that term very loosely, are absolutely shocking. Like you said, they are effectively in the nude. And then at the end of the contest, we have the surprise of Mae Young turning up, who at this stage, I'm guessing she was in her late 70s, potentially, maybe even her 80s. Turning up and effectively exposing her breasts, I suppose, to try and put a sensible term to it. I mean, she was actually wearing a bodysuit, apparently, the WWE claimed, so she wasn't genuinely topless. But
okay,
we watch it back on the network, there's big X's and it says censored and everything's blanked out and so on. You actually watch it there and then, it wasn't well edited at all, and you could effectively see things that you probably didn't want to see.
Mark Henry's in there really selling it as well, trying to drag her out of the ring.
Yeah. I mean, Mae Young, fair play. She came across like she was always up for anything, wasn't she? Like powerbombed through tables and all sorts of stuff. Fair play to the lady. But that sight of Mae Young, effectively topless, waving what she has around for everyone to view live on Channel 4, really did not go down well with the UK broadcaster. Also, the violence in the table match and the street fight also came as a bit of a shock to Channel 4.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then apparently some people, I suppose the term would be in the know, I guess, say that already Channel 4 had decided from this one event alone not to renew their contract after the first 12 months just because of what that content was.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The next pay-per-view they broadcast was Backlash in April. To counteract some of the issues that they had with this first experience of WWE television, they broadcast on a 50-minute delay. So let's put that into context. It's not a couple of minutes. It's not 5 minutes. Nearly an hour delay on this. So they could edit... they could digitize the blood. They could sort of blank out some of the blood if it happened. They could cut out bad language and cut out anything they felt unsuitable. Now, bear in mind, in the UK, this is going out at 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, and so on. So it's well past the watershed, but they were still very much anti-broadcasting this sort of thing. There was a big backlash from UK wrestling fans about the show being broadcast on this delay and so heavily edited. And eventually Channel 4 kind of relaxed a little bit on that, but when their 12-month contract ran out, they basically just said, nope, we're not renewing it, and everything went back to Sky, and that was the end of that kind of little experiment. So as great
this
as it was,
so much
sorry
explains so much sorry I was saying this explains so much from my childhood. And like when you said it was broadcast on a 50-minute delay, I've just got flashbacks in my mind to seeing the little TV guides or whatever, probably paper TV guides you had in those days, with like wrestling on at 00:50.
Yeah,
like 1:50 in the morning. I was like, that's a really weird time to start an event. Maybe it's like 10 minutes before they actually start or something. But no, they're broadcasting on a 50-minute delay, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Just to cut out all the boobs and blood.
This naivety that I have to that era is going to be a running thread throughout this conversation. I think it's going to unlock some memories. It should be fun.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, okay. I mean, with that sort of covered now, that we don't need to go back and view that any further. I suppose we'll jump back to the start of the show, shall we? We have the Royal Rumble 2000. It's coming to us from Madison Square Garden. Very much a, I suppose, mecca or home turf of WWE and WWF, and of course WWWF before that. It's very much their territory when it was all territory days. We have 19,231 in the garden. That's a sellout, with well over 16,500 have paid, which is a huge number, which gives the WWE the first ever time they've taken over $1 million at the gate at Madison Square Garden ever in their history, which is quite a big thing, I guess, in the history of the business there. And they also take well over $150,000 in merchandise. So, I mean, the numbers are spectacular. It's all guns a-blazing for the WWF at this time. Even though Stone Cold is seen as the golden goose of this era, he is not around due to his neck surgery and health issues he's having. So he's currently out of the picture. And this pay-per-view is very much built around the other part of the top two, I guess, with The Rock. What did you think when you sort of pressed play over the last day or so, rewatching this pay-per-view and seeing Madison Square Garden decked out the way it was with the entranceway and so on for the first time in however many years it's been since you watched the show?
I love Madison Square Garden pretty much solely because you have that camera shot from the back of the room where you're looking down at the entranceway.
Yes.
And particularly for Royal Rumbles, it's amazing, right? Because they're all coming running out at the camera. But particularly for this one, where they had the entranceway sort of decked out like sort of a back alley kind of thing, with the car above it and the road painted on the floor and all the light stuff littered on the sides.
And the graffiti,
coming into the first segment with Taz and Angle, it made it for me. And that Taz and Angle segment is still my favorite part of this event. And it's the one thing that I always remember when I think back on it. It just stuck in my mind, and I think it's such a brilliant piece of pro wrestling. I still do.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Kurt Angle comes out looking very young, fresh-faced, and still has plenty of hair on his head, and looks in absolutely fantastic shape. Cuts a bit of a promo about how New York can take him as their hero, and he's wrestling a mystery opponent, isn't he?
And by this point, I already hate him. Like 13-year-old me is sitting watching the TV like, who is this guy?
Yeah.
What on earth? Like, he's like a typical American fresh-faced jock coming out, being overconfident. He's perfectly riding the crowd up there as well. And you just can't wait to see him get beat up. And I think that was the moment I really started enjoying wrestling.
Waiting for Angle to get his comeuppance. Yeah, he's very, I suppose he's quite conceited, he's quite arrogant, he's quite smarmy in a way. He's kind of patronizing with some of the things he says to the crowd as well. And you're right, he's watching it and you think, oh, I just hope someone smashes him straight in the mouth really, really soon. Which is, I suppose, the exact reaction he wants, isn't it?
Yeah.
And when Taz makes his entrance, when he's unveiled as the mystery opponent, the reaction from the crowd is insane. The pop from the audience is huge. I mean, before he actually comes out, even though it's a mystery that it's going to be him, they are chanting, "We want Taz," certain sections of the crowd. He's from New York himself, Brooklyn, New York, so he's a hometown boy. And yeah, very, very quick match, only like 3 minutes or so, but it was really interesting seeing Taz and Angle from 20 years ago.
So the moment that I loved Taz was like his music hits. You get the boop, boop,
yeah,
boop, boop, and then his music hits and they kind of pan to the entrance and it just looks like he's walking through the streets of Brooklyn in that little back alley. And it's just perfect. It's just a perfectly captured little moment. And then he gets in and he's awesome already and he starts like kicking Angle's ass. And from that moment, I just started to love Taz as well. Like, they're trading suplexes. It's a perfect little TV match. And it ends in that really special way where, like, you think it's going to be the end of the suplex off the top, but it's not. I don't know if that was meant to be a three count that got cancelled or not meant to be a three count that got cancelled. But then they continue for a little bit longer, and then he locks in the Taz. And, like, Lawler's going, that's a choke, what you're doing, that's illegal. And JR's going, well, he's out. He lost. And then Angle's selling from that point onwards, and they sell it like a proper injury, and he gets carted out. And it becomes a storyline that carries over as well later in the show. And again, panning back to the naive me sitting there, 13 years old, watching it, I'm like, what just happened? Like, I wanted that guy to get his ass kicked, but did he just get really hurt? Or, like, because you don't know, like, wrestling's not meant to be real, and you kind of know that at 13 years old in 2000, but it was really one of those moments that was just done well, that it, like, I bought into it. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Something that I'm hoping we can sort of get a little insight into that you may be able to provide, as opposed to other people who look back on shows with me, is obviously being a wrestler yourself, having worked in the ring yourself. Certain moments or certain moves in the ring, I think maybe be able to get a different perspective from you, having been there. Taz got in some trouble very early on in his WWF run and was labeled dangerous to a degree by certain people backstage. Again, these are Taz's words, you know, from interviews that I've seen with him, because they had an issue with some of the ways he would suplex people, and especially when he would release them, and effectively that they'd just be sailing through the air, and that was seen as being dangerous. He wasn't controlling his opponent very well. It's again the words that I've seen Taz use on shoot interviews years after this event. What are your thoughts here now, looking at this in 2020, with the experiences you have? Did you see anything there that you look at and think, well, okay, you need to be a bit careful there? Or is it more dangerous if someone's literally just releasing you in the middle of a suplex than potentially guiding you down, or however it works?
I mean, as a general point, there are various ways to do any particular wrestling move, as long as it's safe when you execute it and you're not hurting people and you can consistently do something safely and not hurt them. Mm-hmm. I never really see an issue with it. And I didn't, like, when watching this back, see anything particularly and go, oh, that looked a bit like borderline. But obviously if Taz says people have pulled him up on it before, then maybe there's particular incidents or whatever that relates to. But yeah, in this match, I don't remember seeing anything in that match that kind of made me, like, cringe or wince, not compared to some of the other stuff that that you see later on. But, like, there's some suplexes that he does that are unique to him that other people don't really do, like the head and arm capture one.
Yes.
That they did off the top rope. I was like, wow, that's, like, it looked safe as houses when he did it there. But you can see how that can go wrong if, like, either one of you isn't completely clued in on what you're supposed to be doing with it. And maybe, like, I don't know the details of those stories, but you can see how with certain moves that are a little bit different to the norm, that sometimes that can happen. And, like, hopefully adults can have the discussion about it and just either work to improve any flaws or just kind of cut things out that they don't feel are safe.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Again, that's exactly the sort of thing I'm looking for. It's great hearing that insight from someone who's more experienced than, well, definitely more experienced than me, and I'd imagine quite a few people who are listening, with regards to an in-ring standpoint. Whilst we're talking about Taz, actually, obviously the biggest, I would guess the biggest stumbling block, to use a phrase there, for Taz would be his height in the WWF. It's been widely acknowledged for many, many, many years as, I suppose, Land of the Giants, I suppose some people call it. Taz is only 5'8". An interesting thing happening around this time in January 2000 was that there's a group of people in WCW who have just been sent their releases from WCW. Those include Conan and Shane Douglas, who eventually would stay on with WCW for a bit longer. But the others are Dean Malenko, Perry Saturn, Eddie Guerrero, and Chris Benoit, who went on to be known as the Radicals in the WWF not long after this. I mean, they debuted maybe end of January going into February. They aren't particularly... Benoit and Eddie Guerrero are the two that I was sort of looking at. They aren't particularly big either. They're quite, you know, very, very athletically fit, very muscular gentlemen, don't get me wrong. But height-wise, they don't compare with some of the big monsters that they've had in the WWE in the past. They then go on to great success and world titles, but then fade back into the mid-card not long after. What do you think about that with regards to size and height in professional wrestling? Is there a way of having someone like a Taz, who's only 5'8", being believable and effectively a big money draw, I guess, which that's what everyone wants, isn't it? It's all about the money end of the day. Could you see somebody like that headlining pay-per-views on a regular basis for the WWF in the future?
I think you only have to look at Daniel Bryan to see that it's possible. Daniel Bryan, he's probably around the same height, isn't he?
Became the closest
thing they had to a superstar like that came organic that they've had in quite a while. There's advantages and disadvantages to being tall when you're wrestling from a mechanical standpoint. With Taz and his human suplex machine gimmick, like having a lower center of gravity helps you get your hips underneath the person and throw them. So that, like, okay. If you want to look at it from a mechanical or even a kayfabe perspective, I guess his height worked to his advantage with his gimmick. But then at the same time, obviously, particularly at the time, and like watching this show back now, like everybody does look big, don't they? Like if you compare it to watching NXT, everybody looks like they are large 6 foot and over human beings that are really built, and like the smaller guys therefore stand out because of it. These days you're seeing many more smaller guys in wrestling. I don't see any particular reason why one of them couldn't become like a big superstar if the stars aligned. But it's the same thing as like a taller guy becoming a big superstar. Like it really has to be sort of that real mix of somebody who can just stand out and capture the attention of not just wrestling fans, but the wider mainstream audience as well. There's no formula for that. It just kind of has to happen.
No, I understand. You make some really good points. I mean, thinking about Taz with his low center of gravity, shall we say, and the human suplex machine gimmick, that makes so much sense how you explained that there. And I suppose as well, when you look at Benoit, again, I think Benoit was 5'10", maybe. Not a short individual by any stretch of the imagination, but looking in the world of pro wrestling, especially in the WWF, he's not the tallest. He used a great deal of suplexes as well, so maybe that helped with him. And I suppose Guerrero had that incredible charisma, didn't he, that sort of ended up getting people backing him no matter what as well.
They had to have that extra something, didn't they? If they were not like the physical specimen, I think is probably the term that I hear Vince in my head using. If they're not the physical specimen, they have to have something else, don't they? They have to have something to capture the attention of the audience. And with Benoit, it's probably his intensity. Sorry, it's my rabbit sneezing in the background.
No worries.
With Benoit, I think it's probably his intensity. With Eddie, obviously, it's his incredible charisma and mind for it and things like that. But there's always something special, like particularly in this era, about sort of any of the smaller guys who really got pushed to that main event level. There's something really special about them.
Yeah, no, I agree. Okay, moving on to the next match, we have the Dudleys versus the Hardys. in a tables match. Before we go to the match itself, we have an interview with the Hardys, who is with Terry Runnels. I completely forgot that she was associated with the Hardys when they first started out, and it seemed weird seeing her with them. It just looked odd to me on screen. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so did I. I was like, oh, that was a thing. I didn't remember that at all.
Yeah.
It's like, obviously with the Hardys, you just think Hardys and Lita, don't you?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't even know how many years that actually went on for. Like, there's this expansive time in pro wrestling, which must have only been like 3 years long, where like The Rock was a megastar and like the Hardys and Lita were a thing, and like it was all tables, tag team matches and stuff, which in my mind was like my entire childhood. But like I can imagine it probably only lasted, what, 3 or 4 years maximum?
Yeah, well, I mean, Edge won his first world title as a singles in 2005.
Oh, there you go, maybe five.
But this is when he was, like, the heel character with Lita, and that's January 2005, so very early. So, yeah, you know, you might be accurate there, sort of 3 to 4 years, because obviously the tag teams would have split and so on before that, I guess. So, yeah, I think you're pretty accurate there, saying 3 to 4 years. But, I mean, what a 3 to 4 years it was for tag team wrestling.
Incredible. Yeah. Absolutely fantastic.
With the match we're seeing here, the rules are basically you need to put both of your opponents through a table to win. And there is some insane moments in this, isn't there? Some quite uncomfortable chair shots as well. Crazy bumps.
Yes. The beginning of the chair shots for the evening, which, watching them in 2020, make me intensely uncomfortable. And then there's a moment where... there's a moment where the Dudleys set up the steel steps in the ring and put a table on top of it.
Yes.
So they can drive Matt through it.
That's right. And that ticks him off the list, I suppose, as he's eliminated, sort of thing, I guess, yeah.
And like they're setting that up and like, oh my God, he's going to hit the steps. Oh my God, he's going to hit the steps. Oh my God, he's going to hit. And then they do it and it's perfect. And he goes to the table and lands safely. But for some reason, I have huge anxiety watching these things now. Whereas as a kid, I'd have been like, yeah, that was so great. This is amazing. I think I've ruined wrestling for myself in some extent by taking part in it. Maybe it's just being an adult as well, that you don't want, like... So I don't remember how everything in these matches goes. You just remember, like, the key points, right? Or the things that stand out to you, right? And I didn't remember this moment at all. And I'm like, oh my God, is he going to like get horribly hurt doing this in some way? But no, it was fine. Like, obviously they're professionals, and there's no reason it wouldn't be fine. But it's an interesting like reaction that I had to it that I noticed. And then there's a moment sort of shortly after that as well that is just absolute chaos, where I think Devon is like standing on the outside and... Matt tries to jump off of something to put him through a table and he moves, and Matt goes crashing through the table, and then he like rests against his other table that's leaning against the outside barriers, and Jeff just comes out of nowhere and the camera pretty much misses him as Devon moves and he just goes crashing what looked like head first through this table into the barrier. I'm like, oh my God, he's dead.
Yeah.
And I know he's not dead because I know Jeff Hardy's still alive. But I'm like, oh my God, he's dead.
Yeah, totally. And that was... Matt came off the top rope all the way to the floor, didn't he? Basically through a table. And he was trying to do like a leg drop,
yeah.
I think. That to me is incredible because if I sit down too quickly, I hurt my arse. And this guy's dropped. I mean, how far is that? He must be dropping 15 foot, 16 foot.
Yeah. It's at least 10, isn't it? Like if you... Think about it, you're standing on the floor, like wrestling ring, it's 3 or 4 foot off the floor, and then it's like, well, maybe like if he gets a bit of height, it's 10 foot.
Mm.
And then the table will only break your fall so much. So that's not a nice bump. But then Jeff's was even worse looking.
And you said about him just coming out of nowhere, that's exactly what it was. It's just like a flash across the screen for a second, wasn't he?
And it's those moments that made like that era of tag team wrestling, though, I guess, what it was, because it was just chaos and carnage and bits of broken things flying everywhere. And it's so exciting to watch, but I can't imagine the price they paid for those few years. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few other moments that are worth mentioning as well. Jeff Hardy gives a chair shot to Bubba Ray on the outside that is terrible. It's just, yeah. His arms are down by his side and he takes it full-fledged in the head. And then he does this crazy run across the barricade, the crowd barricade, which we've seen him do a few times before, haven't we, where he sort of turns it into a move as he jumps off. But in the meantime, whilst he's running across the barricade, which is incredible to see anyway, somebody managing to do that and not fall, Bubba Ray Dudley has picked up a table and just throws a table at him and hits him straight in the head with it. It's insane.
Yeah. But, and then it bounces back and hits Bubba in the head, and like, he's selling it, but he's selling it beautifully. But that must have hurt, like, as well, because he throws it and it just ricochets straight back into his face. And I don't know if that was like the metal bit that caught him or the wooden bit that caught him. And like, I don't know. I wouldn't have wanted to be part of that match. I was just crazy from start to finish. Like, the very first spot made me go, oh my God, because they do a backdrop. And instead of moving the table out of the way, I think Matt flips it out of the way. And Jeff comes like a foot from being impaled on one of the legs of the table.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, yeah, this is going to be scary the entire through.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the thing as well with Bubba Ray and Devon, I suppose Matt Hardy as well, you see they're kind of, I mean, there's no way of doing it that is going to not hurt. But you can see they're sort of, to my untrained eyes, I guess, they're falling through a table in a certain way. And Bubba Ray, when he takes the big bump at the end off the balcony, you can see he's kind of doing it. He's doing it in a way that's familiar to my eyes, if that makes sense. Whereas if you look at Jeff, he's got arms and legs flailing everywhere. He's going through things hip first, shoulder first, head first, sideways. It's just, he's a crash test dummy, isn't he? He's just, you know.
Yeah. I think he just has no regard for, he had no regard for his own well-being at the time, just like, but it's incredible to watch, isn't it? Like, with Bubba's bump off the balcony, like, there's the spectacle of the tables stacked on top of tables, which, obviously I've never had any reason to even think about taking that bump.
That was something I was going to ask you, actually, if you have any experience of doing this, yeah.
I never really planned to. I've never really been like a weapons wrestling guy, mm-hmm. you know that. But like, each table will break your fall to an extent. But like, you're still falling from a height through some tables onto what is effectively concrete at the bottom. Yeah. It can't be pleasant either way. And then the match finishes. Obviously, Bubba takes that bump through the tables, and then Jeff does the swanton from the balcony. Looks like he crushes Devon on the way down through the table. And then Matt like immediately picks him up to go and celebrate in the ring. And like, again, he's selling, but he's selling it so well. And I can't imagine how much like pain they must have been in by that time from all the random carnage that they've just been through.
Yeah.
But it's incredible to watch. Incredible.
It is. I mean, it's amazing as well with how we're describing this and the stunts and the spots and the moments we're talking about here. And there's plenty there that we haven't covered as well. That it was only just over 10 minutes. They managed to fit so much in to a relatively short period of time, considering what they were doing, I think. And it's just 100 miles an hour, excitement from bell to bell. I really enjoyed this match. I thought it was great.
Fantastic.
After that, the next contest is actually the Miss Rumble silliness, but we won't go back.
Yeah, moving on.
Yeah, we won't go back to that. Yes, the next actual wrestling match we have is for the Intercontinental Championship. We have Chris Jericho, who is co-champions with China, where they've had a kind of messy, schmozzy finish to a match in the past, and they're kind of both declared as champion for a short period here. Against Hardcore Holly in a triple threat. Jericho eventually wins the contest to become sole champion. One of my first thoughts here when this contest started was, Bob Holly looks absolutely jacked. He looks ripped.
He looks incredible in this, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Fresh as a daisy. His drop kicks are amazing.
Oh, that's another note I've got here. What a drop kick, yep.
Yeah. Like, he's known for them, isn't he? But, like, every time you see one, you have to applaud it. They're amazing. I thought there were some really nice moments in this match. Particularly the... they set up for the superplex, and both guys got hung up and then just did the superplex. And, like, the finish was pretty smart in the end. Like, with Jericho sort of having the ref distracted until the moment where he could take advantage of it. I thought it was a fun little match. I enjoyed it.
Apparently there's a moment in the match, according to Jericho, listening to one of his podcasts, and I think Jim Ross might have mentioned it as well on one of his podcasts, that Jim Ross explains it as China would like things explained out step by step. She wasn't very good at sort of improv in the ring. To quote Jim Ross, this is obviously not my words, these are his. And there was a moment where Jericho kind of lost his way. I looked out for it when I was watching it back. I couldn't find it. I don't know if it's been edited from the network, because they do tend to do a lot of that now. But apparently there's a moment, there's footage out there, whether it's on YouTube or whatever, I'll see if I can track it down and share it on the show's Twitters, where Jericho kind of loses his way. China's stood there with her back to him, and you can quite clearly, apparently, hear Hardcore Holly letting Jericho know what to do next, because Jericho's lost his way. And apparently he screams, "Effing bulldog her, dumbass." So I'm really looking forward to trying to track that down, and if I can sample it to have it as my text alert on my phone, I'm going to do that.
Is that the very end? Because does he not the bulldog and the lion saw, and that's the finish, right? When she's got him in the she got him in the Walls of Jericho, didn't she?
That's right. Yeah.
And then she goes bulldog lion saw finish. So it could be there. Maybe I'll watch it back.
That's what I was looking back on today, having remembered this little bit that Jericho and Jim Ross had mentioned on previous podcasts of theirs, just because it's, you know, the impressions that Jericho especially did of Hardcore Holly in a sort of southern accent he put on, just effing bulldog or dumb, just tickled me. But I mean, Chris Jericho, the guy's an absolute star even here, isn't he? You can just look at him and think, why, look at this bloke, he's just different class.
Yeah, he's fantastic. Like, one of my favourites from that era as well. He was for, like, pretty much everybody, I would imagine, just because he's so entertaining. Like, yeah. Pretty much everybody.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Well, I said Jericho wins the contest and is the sole IC champion here. Following that match, we go backstage and we have the first sighting of a gentleman who's gone on to be an absolute megastar. The Rock, and he's cutting a little interview here with, was it Michael Cole he was with, or was it the coach on this occasion?
Briefly with Michael Cole, I think, wasn't it? And then he sacks off Michael Cole and he's over by himself, as he often does.
And that's what the coach was at, the WWF restaurant, wasn't he, in New York? He was there around, yeah, that's right. I mean, that's a bit disappointing, isn't it? You see the cuts of these, due respect to Jonathan Coachman, but you see these cuts to the restaurant from other pay-per-views, and the Big Show is there and Shawn Michaels is there. Imagine going along to this one and you're excited as to who you're going to get, and you've got Jonathan Coachman walking around with a microphone. I'd be a little bit disappointed, but there we go.
I don't know, Coach was a bit of a star back in the day, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, he had that little run
in his own way
where he was wrestling as well, didn't he face off against Jerry Lawler on a pay-per-view at some stage?
Oh, they've had all the commentators do something at one point or another, haven't they?
Yeah, Michael Cole is undefeated at WrestleMania.
Less said about those, the better as well, I think.
In The Rock's interview here, there's a little line that stood out that really tickled me. He's asked about what he thinks his chances are in the Rumble match later, and who he should be looking out for as potential threats, I guess. And he says that if he can avoid Headbanger Mosh and Crash Holly, he thinks he has a good chance. I don't know why, but it just really tickled me.
Yeah, because it comes across as absurd, right? But it also gets those guys' names out there a little bit. I think it's like, and he's not doing it to like crap on those people. I think he's doing it to kind of have a humorous moment where, but also to make sure people kind of like look out for him, because they'll be there.
Yeah. I mean, we'll come to the Headbangers shortly when they enter the Rumble in their interesting attire. After we've seen The Rock, we get another tag team match. This time it's for the championships, the WWF Tag Team Championships, and we have the New Age Outlaws, Billy Gunn and Road Dogg, defending against the Acolytes, who eventually obviously became the APA, of Bradshaw and Farouk. Very short contest here, less than 3 minutes from bell to bell. My first thought was that two things that stood out when the New Age Outlaws were making their entrance to the ring was, one, I love those tag team title belts. I'm a bit of a belt geek, and I love those old WWF Tag Team Championship belts. And it looked like B Gunn had borrowed my 13-year-old daughter's choker, the sort of necklace thing he was wearing. That was a little bit of an odd clothing choice, but each to their own, I guess.
I didn't notice that. How did I not notice that?
It's quite an interesting, you know, the sort of rubbery, it goes tight around your neck sort of thing. That,
oh, interesting.
My 13-year-old daughter and my 10-year-old daughter would definitely both wear one, put it that way. So, not much really to go on here. Such a short contest. I mean, the clothesline from hell from Bradshaw looked impressive, as it always does. As a guy who's got extensive tag team experience, what did you think of this quick, short contest?
I enjoyed it. Like, to get a tag team match in 3 minutes isn't the easiest job in the world. And I think it was chaos in its own different little way without being destruction at the same time. Like, it really picked up again towards the end as well, with X-Pac coming in, interrupting, and then Billy Gunn coming in from the outside. There's a thing that I had to rewatch because I thought Farouk was just standing around at the end. So X-Pac comes in, that's a wheel kick on Bradshaw, some other stuff happens, I think Farouk takes him out, and then Billy Gunn comes in from the outside and does the Famouser on Bradshaw. And it looks like Farouk just walks off, but Farouk walks off, and then at the ropes, you've got Road Dogg holding his leg.
Yes.
And that's the reason the three count can happen. And I thought the camera sort of missed it, but I thought that was really well coordinated by them, really.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like, at first glance, it kind of looks like he's just milling about, doesn't it? And he could stop the count if he wanted, but he's obviously being prevented by Road Dogg, sort of just out of shot from certain angles, isn't he?
Yeah, exactly. So he essentially went to grab Road Dogg, I think, and he just grabbed his legs. But that's all they needed to do to tidy it, to kind of make sure that Farouk, he was just making sure Farouk couldn't break up the pin. But when I first saw it, because the camera missed it, I was like, why didn't he break it up? Damn. That's good. I enjoyed it. I thought I enjoy quick matches sometimes more than I enjoy sort of longer matches, because it's just all action, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. With regards to that, then, that finish we've seen there, again, someone such as yourself who's got a decent amount, a very good amount of tag team experience, how difficult is that to get the timing right there? I mean, the reason I ask is because we see that niche done there well, with Farouk not able to break up the count and so on. But I've also gone back for other shows in the last month or two and been viewing a lot of early 90s WCW. And I don't want to be seen as picking on the guy, but Stevie Ray from Harlem Heat, for two pay-per-views in a row, kind of missed times when he's trying to get in the ring and break the count up. It's going to be going to the three count, but he arrives too early. And on one pay-per-view in particular, I think it was Halloween Havoc 93, there was a six-man opener there. He's literally stood above his brother getting pinned and does nothing, and it kind of looks a bit daft. I mean, how difficult is that? Because I suppose if you go a second too early, you have the Stevie Ray issue that I witnessed at Halloween Havoc. If you go a second too late, you might not get picked up on, or how difficult.
And then the referee
that?
Has to cover or something.
Yeah.
There's in a standard tag match, right, there's five people that need to know what's going on pretty much all times. You've got your two tag teams of people and the referee. So keeping everyone on the same page isn't always super easy, particularly if you're doing something that is a little chaotic or out of the ordinary or whatever, making sure that everybody is in the right spot at the right time for the right thing. Like, often takes like practice or just repetition to be able to get it to a point where you're not having to like cover for each other maybe. And there is kind of a real art to it. And I don't want to talk it up too much. Like at the end of the day, it's like everybody has their thing that they need to do. And you just, it's just on you to do it. But you like, essentially you're trying to avoid that situation at the end of a match where it looks like somebody could have break it up, but didn't, for whatever reason, because it just makes them look a bit daft, like you say. And you don't want to be too late and then need to break it up because that makes the referee look a bit daft. And then like all of that stuff individually, like has an impact on the ability for the crowd or the people at home watching it to kind of suspend their disbelief and really get into what's going on. And obviously if you're invested in a match, and like it's coming to that point at the end where you're like, oh, you're either like, I really want this to be the three count, or I really don't want this to be the three count. And something jarring happens, it can take out of the rest of it completely. So avoiding it is like, it, these guys are professionals. They do it day in, day out. Like there's like accidents happen or whatever, or you mistakes happen, but like for the most part, they'll get it right 10 times out of 10. But coordination and practice and repetition, I guess.
Yeah, that makes sense. I suppose it's like anything, isn't it? The more you do it, the better you get, in theory, I guess.
Okay. If you treat it like it's real and react as well, then you like you know if like you want to be breaking up a pin or not, because your team wants to win, right? So if you can, you should be trying to break it up. And it's always nice to, if you can, be able to be in that mindset when you're out there performing, because it helps. If you are in the mindset of believing, then it helps everybody else to be in the mindset of believing.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose all wrestling fans are. It's not unique just to Miss South or people I watch with, but the whole suspension of disbelief is a big thing for me, especially when I watch with my daughters. And if I'm took out of the moment for any reason, it is quite frustrating from a fan's standpoint. For me personally, I guess. And I also at times wonder, has my daughter noticed that? Because she still very much believes. So I kind of want to keep that upheld as long as possible. I know, I mean, she's 11 next week, so time's running out, I think. But it's I would be more upset about her learning that wrestling is a work, shall we say, than her learning at Father Christmas. The wrestling thing is going to upset me more, you know. So.
Yeah. Like, and this is the thing, isn't it? Like, I always, on a personal note, I always think the best crowds are the ones that are either a lot of families or just a lot of people who are just really into like the storylines or the matches or the stories you're trying to tell in whatever way. Because they are therefore invested in the outcomes. And when you've got people who are invested in the outcomes or investing in the rules being followed or the story conclusion that they want to see, then you get people who are genuinely excited about the outcomes of the matches. And that's when you get like the sort of reactions that give you goosebumps and stuff. And that's really cool.
Yeah, definitely. And then reactions are, to me, a great deal of what it's all about. Sort of drawing emotion and reaction out of people. I mean, on one occasion that stands out to me in particular is watching yourself wrestle with the Heritage City Hitmen. And I've told you plenty of times in the past, I'm a big fan of your work. I love watching you wrestle. So I'm sort of half stood up on my chair at the back. I believe it was in like a school in Churchdown that was putting on a show there. And I sort of half stood up at the back and started applauding. And my youngest, Charlie, who, you know, obviously you're doing your job correctly because she couldn't stand you. So she's literally grabbing my hands and trying to pull my hands down so I can't clap you. So you've got the reaction from my daughter there that I guess you want. So that sort of thing. I love that. That's wonderful. I love watching the kids and so on and people's reactions to stuff live, to stuff on the television. That's the kind of thing you want.
It's genuine emotion, genuine like reactions that are really the stuff that makes me at least want to kind of keep going out there and doing some wrestling and kind of generating more of those moments, because it just feels special. It's great. It's sort of one of the simplest theatrical art forms in the world in sort of the storytelling sense. You're just telling the story of someone trying to win and someone trying to lose. But it's sort of how you go about that and the various things that kind of surround that that really kind of make each thing unique.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, then. I suppose speaking about reactions and emotions, shall we get on to what I think is the real reason we're here? The street fight between Cactus Jack and Triple H for the WWF title?
Absolutely. This was a thing, right? This is one of the more intense sort of 20 minutes, however long it was, I've sat through in quite a while. Like, watching this act, there's so much that I probably didn't appreciate as a teenager watching it. And just thought it was super cool, and I don't know how they're pulling off all this fake blood and stuff.
Right.
Because it can't be real, right? Because, like, Triple H is bleeding all over himself for like 15 of the 20 minutes or whatever, and like there's barbed wire on a piece of wood, and
Reaction that got as well. But when the barbed wire 2x4 came out, it got a bigger reaction from the crowd than some of the wrestlers coming out in the Rumble.
Yeah, it did. Because I mean, I don't know. Like I say, this is my first wrestling event. Definitely didn't know at the time whether this was a normal thing in pro wrestling, and like I feel like I don't really have a lot of context around it, because I've gone back and watched like late 90s early 2000s again in the past, but I've not watched it all the way through. Like, they did such a good job of telling you the story that led up to it through the video, just as they always do. Like, the WWF video packages, WWE video packages are always fantastic at kind of recapping those stories, particularly in that era as well. And as a kid watching it particularly, like, they were the only way I knew what was going on in any of them. So I guess they knew that they had to be spot on with them. Because I wasn't seeing Raw or SmackDown on a weekly basis. I was literally just watching the pay-per-views like 12 times a year and a bit of Sunday Heat. So, like, the video package where, like, they show the run-up, Mankind, feel like, oh, okay, but you're not wrestling Mick Foley, you're wrestling Cactus Jack. Like, I didn't know who Cactus Jack was watching this for the first time, but I knew he was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was all done so well. And then the match starts, and it's brutal from the get-go. And they're going outside, and people getting hit with the ring bell, and they're going through tables, sort of. The table doesn't really collapse, and it looks worse for it somehow. And then Triple H gets his leg cut, and then he gets cut in the head, and he's bleeding everywhere. And he's doing this, he does this amazing sell at one point. I don't know if it stood out to you, but it really stood out to me, where he's like selling against like the ring. He's like almost falling out of the ring, holding on. And instead of like putting his head forward, he like tilts it back, so his blood like drips down his chest.
Yeah.
It's like awareness and stuff like that, I guess, that really makes him the amazing performer that he is, to kind of be able to generate those visuals that kind of stick with you of this brutal, like, it was a street fight, it was a fight, isn't it? Hmm. It's not a wrestling contest, not at all. But I remember sitting and watching this as a kid and being like, wow, this is violent. And I think my parents are sitting there a bit uncomfortable. They're letting a 13-year-old watch like a guy bleeding everywhere while another guy like hits him with a barbed wire bat and stuff. And like, you really want to watch this? son? Yeah, I really want to. Yeah, this is cool. This is really great. Now I'm watching it and I'm seeing the chair shots and I'm going, oh God, please don't do that. Please don't do that. And now I know I'm old. But it's a spectacle.
Yes.
I don't want to see people do it ever again, but it's got its moment in history, I suppose, isn't it? And
yeah, definitely. The whole Cactus Jack, Mick Foley storyline around this time, I think is brilliant. Him and Triple H, that they have this contest here. Obviously, he's been wrestling him as Mankind. And you say there that when he did the reveal of he's going to be Cactus Jack, you were unsure, you didn't really know who Cactus Jack was. I was very much the other way. Cactus Jack was, the Mick Foley persona, Cactus Jack was my guy. I loved Cactus Jack. From watching WCW when it was on ITV back in the early 90s.
Okay.
You had WCW Worldwide that used to be shown around the same time as Baywatch and Gladiators and all that sort of stuff. Bullseye and, you know, that sort of Saturday afternoon viewing.
Yeah.
It was like their version of Velocity or Heat, I guess. But then, as I got older, you could buy tapes in the city centre. There was a dingy, smelly little shop next to a barber's down an alleyway in Gloucester, and it was rank, mind. It smelled of damp.
Why are the video stores always unkempt?
Yeah, it was gross.
I remember them. I remember the smell of them.
Yeah, you walk in, it smelled damp. It smelled like mould. Yeah, but you used to go there and you'd be able to buy VHS tapes, and then have them for a while, and he would buy them back off you, or he would buy other tapes. So effectively, you were tape trading with a guy who was running this little second-hand store. He had like a load of LP records in the corner, so I used to flick through and pick out some old headline albums and then get my wrestling tapes and so on. I started getting some of Foley's work from his time in Japan, a couple of bits from ECW. Not intentional. I was just picking up these tapes that were cheap, and I'd buy, say, I don't know, I'd buy something like Master of Puppets by Metallica on vinyl from there, and I'd have like £2 or £3 left, and this cassette was £2 or £3, so I just bought it because it fitted into what I had left in my pocket money when I was a kid, or as I got a bit older as well. So I'd end up watching these Foley matches sort of by accident, I guess. So when he did the whole reveal on that episode of SmackDown of Cactus Jack, because I weren't a massive Mankind fan when he first went through that character, because I saw him as Cactus Jack and it was brutal and the ear getting ripped off against Vader and all this sort of stuff. But when he revealed that Cactus Jack, I remember watching that 20 years ago and thinking, why is Cactus Jack? You know, and being like super excited.
So let's flip this one then. Did this live up to your expectations as someone who knew Cactus Jack and knew what he was capable of from those past matches? Did it fit the bill?
Yeah, I think so. And with Cactus Jack, it's not anything specific he does. It's just the insane style of it, I guess. It's more of a, as opposed to a potential particular move set or anything like that, it's more of a attitude, I guess. I'm sort of struggling for the words a little bit to explain what I mean, but he would take silly bumps as Cactus Jack, and obviously he did the same as Mankind in the WWF, but when he was Cactus Jack, there's a famous match with Vader where he would get Vader to bust him open properly and draw blood from above his eyes with punches, as opposed to, you know, working at it, I guess. He got Vader to, he was like almost in a piggyback position on Vader, and got Vader to drive him onto the floor with Vader on top of him in the hope that he can properly get injured and cash in an insurance policy, because that's how miserable people were in TW in 1993.
Jeez.
Some real, and that was all barbed wire and explosives and Terry Funk and all this crazy stuff. So seeing him with barbed wire, the blood, and so on here, yes, it ticked a lot of the boxes. It's very WWF-esque of that, but it does tick a lot of the boxes. And Foley was, I think he was in great shape here. He's never going to be a super slim, trim Jim, is he? But here he looks quick, he looks sharp, he looks fairly lean in comparison to other times we might have seen him. He just looks in really good shape.
Yeah, and it's the like it's old character as well, isn't it? Like, it's never say die. Mm-hmm. Like, gets hit with some of the most heinous stuff you'll ever see, and is up and walking again within minutes, yeah. And fighting, and like the infamous gang handcuffed and hit the chair thing, which I never ever ever want to see anyone do ever
again. That was the previous year against the Rock. Is that the one you mean, or the one here?
He does it again here. Yeah. Like he handcuffs him, they go outside, Triple H cracks him with a chair on the outside, and then Rock comes in and cracks Triple H with a chair, and the police officer undoes the handcuffs.
Yep, that's right.
And then they head back in and work towards the finish. But, like, viewing now is very different, knowing what we know these days.
Yeah, of course.
With concussions and all that sort of stuff. And you never want to see it again. But, like, again, it's... I don't want to see anyone fall off the top of a Hell in a Cell again either, really. Like, the way that he did. I don't want to... Yeah, like, he is very much... someone who made a living out of wrecking his body, and like I appreciate at the time how amazing I thought it was. Viewing it again, it makes me feel a bit uncomfortable. And I was prepared for that one to make me feel a bit uncomfortable, I think. The things that stood out to me at the very end was the pedigree on the tap.
Yeah.
For the finish. Triple H doesn't let go of the arms.
No, so his face is hitting.
So his face just goes straight into the tax.
Yeah.
And yeah, he obviously wanted that to take it that way. Like, it's totally Mick Foley thing to do. But it's just like amazing and crazy how far they push themselves to entertain people.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, after this, the whole, like I said, Mick Foley, Triple H storyline around this time is superb. Because after this, they go to No Way Out in February. And basically, Foley saying, I know I can beat you. I want another chance. Triple H saying, well, why should I give you another chance? I've already beaten you. So Foley puts his career on the line to try and tempt Triple H into one more match. And they fight within Hell in a Cell. And it's in Bloodbath. It's a bit shorter than this one, but there's tack bumps and so on. I believe there's a moment where there's fire involved as well. It's just more insanity involving these two. Foley ends up having to effectively, you know, retire because defeated there. But then he's brought back by Linda McMahon to be in the main event of WrestleMania in the four-way there with The Rock, Big Show, and Triple H, which is a nice moment because he's been brought back at the time for one last match and the main event WrestleMania, which is something he wanted to do ever since he was a child. So it's a lovely sort of sentimental moment there for Mick Foley getting that opportunity, I guess. But this match here is just insane. Some of the chair shots, and Triple H was thrown into a stack of bricks. They're obviously not legit bricks, but it still looked very uncomfortable. It was super.
I don't know. I wouldn't put it past him to use legit bricks back then.
Yeah. Potentially.
I don't know. But like, the tacks were real. Yeah. I don't know what they do with barbed wire. I've never, like I say, I'm not a hardcore wrestler. I've never been involved in it. Like, I'm sure it's possible to blunt it off, whether they did or not.
It's some use rubber, so it's a rubber barbed wire, so it's not as bad. It's not going to cut you properly or anything like that. Interestingly enough as well, around this time, ECW had ran shows in New York, in areas around that same place, and the New York State Commission had basically told ECW they were banned from using barbed wire because of its graphic content. Okay. This is before the WWE, WWF go there and have this match and use barbed wire themselves. But they were told it was okay because apparently the head of the state commission or potentially a New York judge there was a very close friend to Linda McMahon and other people involved high up in WWE. So he kind of let them get away with it, but told ECW they were not allowed. Which is kind of odd, isn't it? But yeah,
that's politics for you.
Excuse me, I do apologise. Yeah, definitely. And it's all very shady goings on, isn't it? But barbed wire with certain companies, as far as I know, they sometimes use rubber barbed wire. And when I've seen these matches out in Japan, some of the crazy stunt stuff that we used to go on out there in the 90s especially, that was legit barbed wire they'd be using there. You'd see it stick into their skin and the ropes would be replaced with barbed wire and they'd get tangled up and have to get cut out and quite graphic, horrible stuff there. But I'm assuming this here is maybe, like you said, blunted off or partially rubber or something.
I don't think it's, well, I don't know, is the short answer, and the only people who know are the people doing the production. There are moments where it gets caught in the vest of Cactus Jack and stuff that suggests that it's not likely to be rubber, but maybe is just as safe as possible as they use the real deal. But that kind of stuff sort of interests me in a morbid curiosity way, but never in a I want to do this way, so I've never really looked into it.
No, I understand. It's almost like, how does the magician's tricks, I guess, isn't it? You kind of want to know how did that work, I guess. Yeah, I know where you're coming from. Ultimately, after just over 26 minutes, Triple H retains the championship here with a pedigree onto the thumbtacks, as David mentioned. A horrific sight, because they're stuck all around his eye and so on afterwards, but I mean, I enjoyed this, ultimately. I don't mind this style, but again, I wouldn't want to watch it all the time. But I am with you completely on with regards to some of the chair shots. Now what we know, it is quite uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So I suppose that brings us to, I guess, the main event of the show, or the dual main event with the Street Fight, the Royal Rumble match itself. We're told early on, as they're desperately trying to clean the ring of all the thumbtacks and filling, trying to get it all sorted before the entrants come down, we're told that it's 90 seconds this year, the gap between the competitors entering. There obviously goes to WrestleMania to challenge what looks like Triple H at the moment, having just beaten Mick Foley there. I'll be honest with you, I thought this Royal Rumble was okay, but I've seen much better. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought there were enjoyable parts to it. The beginning was pretty cool. I thought, like, they had D'Lo and Grandmaster Sexay in there.
Yeah.
And that was my introduction to Too Cool, who I see a lot thereafter on like Sunday Night Heat and stuff, and really enjoyed. And I thought, I mean, not so much when he first came out, but by the time that sort of Rikishi came out and they had that moment where Rikishi kind of like cleans for a bit and then they had like a slightly awkward stare down and commentators were like, oh yeah, these guys are friends and stuff. And then Scotty comes out and they do the dance bit and he like double crosses them, throws them out, but they're still friends. They do the little like finger thing. So, it was like a fist bump.
Yeah.
But, like,
without the whole fist.
Yeah, I thought that was just a really cool moment, like, and it's those moments in Royal Rumbles that I tend to really enjoy. Like, the format itself sometimes gets a bit, like, drawn out and formulaic. You're like, okay, like, I'll get excited for a few surprises, and, like, but, like, there's often dull moments in between where everyone's just kicking a punch and no one can get eliminated, otherwise the ring would be empty too soon.
Yeah.
But there were some nice moments there. I thought Rikishi looked really good coming out of it, like the moments with Viscera as well, where they had like the big hoss standoff.
Those are two big fellas, aren't they?
Yeah, aren't they just? And I love like moments like that as well, where you've got like two big guys just duking it out. So that was a really cool like couple of minutes. And then it kind of settled into that Royal Rumble pattern thereafter for a bit.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, the comment that you make about Rikishi looking good, He actually had the most eliminations in this Royal Rumble, which is 7. The next to him, I suppose, is The Rock himself, the eventual winner, who had 4. So he's elimination-wise, head and shoulders above everyone else. This is coming into the time when, obviously, Austin is missing at the moment because of his net health issues that we spoke about earlier in the show. Storyline-wise, he's been written out by being hit by a car at Survivor Series the previous year. And people are all guessing who hit him with the car. It does eventually come out that it was Rikishi who did it. And they're building him to be involved in the main event picture sort of throughout the rest of the year. He takes part in a few title matches towards the end of the year, Armageddon in December, for example. So they're trying to build him into something else, I guess. Maybe that's why he had such a good showing. Looking down the list of the people in the match, and of course, I mean absolutely no disrespect to anyone here, but I feel it's kind of lacking star power, really. I mean, to me, it's, I remember at time watching back in 2000 and rewatching now for our conversation today. It's obvious who effectively is going to win. It's The Rock, or as an outsider, potentially The Big Show. There's no sort of grey areas where sometimes you look at maybe 3 or 4 potential winners. And then, you go down the list. You're lacking, I suppose, star power to a degree with big chunks of the entrance here. Does that make sense?
Definitely. I think they kind of telegraphed it a little bit because The Rock had the interview where he was talking about the Royal Rumble, and I don't remember, maybe I missed one when I was watching about one or two, but I don't remember many other people having an interview about whether they were going to win the Rumble or not.
There wasn't.
And that was, like, it struck me as pretty unusual, but I guess I never really paid that much attention. But yeah, it felt like The Rock was the big deal going into this. And likely to become the title challenger coming out of it. But that doesn't mean that I wasn't interested. Like, there were lots of, like, cool little moments. There was a point during the middle of the Rumble where it just became a big low-blow fest.
Yeah.
And, like, everyone was just, like, going to the nearest guy and punching him in the nuts. And that made me chuckle for a bit. And then it kind of picks up again and really, like, properly, I think, at the point The Rock comes in, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He comes in, kind of has a really short, like, fiery moment, and then gets cut back down again, and then The Big Show comes in and becomes, like, between those two, and they're selling that story. It's between those two who's going to win. And then, like, you're like, oh, who might be, like, is there someone else? Prize entrance towards the end, and then, like, the Godfather comes out, and I'm like, oh yeah, the Godfather exists.
I popped for this. I got into this when he came out. Just whenever I hear that guy's, there's two, I suppose, from this era that are very, very of this time. When you hear the meow, meow, at the beginning of the Godfather, you know, I for some reason I just think, oh, brilliant. And the other one is when you hear the Hello Ladies for Val Venus. I don't know why, but I'm just like, oh, excellent, great. For some reason that really resonates with me. I don't know whether it's
just such identifiable characters, aren't they? And yeah. I had the same thing for Val now you mention it, and to a lesser extent Al Snow as well, just because they're such great identifiable characters that, like, as soon as their music hit, I was like, oh, it's this. Hey, I'd forgotten that this guy was in this.
I don't know I don't know how that reflects upon me morally, I suppose. If a porn star and a pimp are super over with me, I don't know, but there we go.
I guess that's the other, talking about weird fashion choices, like, fishnet shirts were pretty all the rage in the early 2000s. I think Christian had one on, Mosh and the Headbangers had one on under his giant green Madonna cones or whatever they were.
Oh yeah, what was that like? Big green furry boobs he had on. What was going on there?
I have no idea. They were a thing, though, weren't they?
Yeah, very odd. And they were talking about he and the other headbanger having this rock alternate lifestyle. I'm not being funny. Yeah. I'm a huge heavy metal and hard rock fan. I have never worn big green fake furry boobs. So I don't see why that's relevant, you know. And I've been to numerous concerts and festivals. I've not seen anyone else wear them either. You know?
I don't know. I'm not one to judge. I thought they were pretty entertaining, nonetheless.
Yeah. The finish is I suppose, quite well known now that the Big Show is about to throw the Rock over the top rope, but both wrestlers kind of stumble over. The Rock holds onto the top rope to pull himself back in, and the Big Show is eliminated. What you don't actually see is that the Rock's feet touched first.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the Rock's feet touched first. They were already on the arena floor when the Big Show went over.
They got a good camera angle on the network for that one where they don't show it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They do end up kind of writing this into the storyline, however, with the Big Show declaring that the Rock's feet touched first. They go to the next month's pay-per-view, which is No Way Out, and have a match to decide who's going into the main event at WrestleMania. You end up at Mania that year, WrestleMania 2000 or WrestleMania 16 to give it its numerical order, with the four-way there of Foley coming back for one last time, Triple H as champion, The Rock and The Big Show because of the controversy with the Rumble in this elimination four-way main event. And that, I think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, people on Twitter right there, but that, I think, is the first time the bad guy has left WrestleMania with the championship, because all this build-up, all these street fights, no DQs, Raw Rumbles, Hell in a Cell matches, McMahon in every corner, all the build-up for it. There's no title change. Triple H still walks out as champion after all that. So I think it's the first time a heel has left WrestleMania as the world champion, actually.
Interesting. All these facts, I have no idea. But they're super interesting, actually. That's so 16 years it took for a belt as a champion.
Yeah, I believe so. I believe so. Let's run through it quickly. Hogan was 1, 2, and 3. Macho Man at 4. 5 was Hogan again. 6 was The Warrior. 7 was Hogan. 8 was Macho Man. 9 was Hogan. 10 was Bret Hart. 11 was Diesel. 12 was Shawn Michaels. 13 was Undertaker. 14 was Austin. 15 was Austin again, wasn't it? So, yeah, 16, yeah, there you go.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, so I'm full of useless little facts like that. There's only so much room in my brain for information. So my head is full of wrestling knowledge, and I've got no qualifications. So there we go.
I love this. I learned so much.
normally when we have a little look back on shows, on pay per views on my show here, David, we sort of, me and the guest each give it a bit of a grade, an old-fashioned sort of school grade, I guess. I mean, for me, I look at this show as having an exciting, eventful, hard-hitting undercard. The Rumble didn't really hit all the notes with me, and I've seen other Rumbles I've enjoyed a lot more, but the undercard I really enjoyed. For me, I probably rate this Royal Rumble 2000 event as a B. How do you view it?
Yeah, I was going to go with B+. And that might just be me looking back at it slightly more fondly as my first ever WWF pay-per-view. But yeah, I think that's pretty fitting, doesn't it? It's a really solid, fun show. And I really enjoyed going back and watching it over the last day or so to do this. So thank you very much.
No problem at all. Before I let you go, do you want to let everyone know whereabouts they can find you online and hopefully follow you on Twitter and Facebook and wherever else, and see your name pop up on future events if we ever do kick this COVID away?
Yeah, sure. And we will eventually. It just takes time. So I hope for the best. On Twitter, I'm HeritageCityHM. On Facebook, you'll just find me as a regular old Add a Friend profile called David Eaton. And I'm on Instagram as well, but I haven't posted on it in a very long time. Heritage City HM as well.
Okay, great stuff. I'd love to have you back on again, David. I really enjoyed. I enjoy the interview aspect to my little show here when I'm speaking with people from various companies and wrestlers and promoters and so on. But I find looking back at old shows something I really, really enjoy myself, and having your perspective on this show that I know is quite a big deal for you, being the first one you watched, I really enjoyed. I'd love to have you back on again to look at other pay-per-views from the past, maybe something you've never seen before. We could look at back to different companies or whatever. I'd be really interested to have you back on if you'd be interested in that, my friend.
100%. Would love to. I really enjoyed it.
Great stuff. Okay. Well, everyone, thank you very much for listening. David, thank you very much for your time, and I will speak to you soon.
Cheers.